I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Warning. The following episode contains subject matter and scenes that some viewers may find upsetting, disturbing, or unnerving. Please note, viewer discretion is advised at all times. Sit back and enjoy.
Chelmsford Police Station.
My name is Jeremy Bamber. My father, Neville, he just called me. He kept saying, Sheila's gone berserk with a gun. Just berserk. Please, you must come and help.
A gun? Who's Sheila? Where's the location, please?
Sheila, she's my sister. They're Tolson Dorsey White House form. Please come quick, help. There are kids inside.
Okay. Yeah, please stay calm. The police are on their way now. Jeremy, at what time did Neville call you?
Welcome back to another I Could Murder a Podcast. It's episode number 7 of series 4. I'm Tom Norris and I'm joined once again by that chap that lives down the road making a racket, Ben Carter.
Sorry.
I'm Tom Norris and I'm joined once again by the man that lives down the road. Avoid his garden, it's Ben Carter.
These shouldn't be getting me.
I'm Tom Norris and I'm joined once again by the man that lives down the road. Don't kick a ball in his garden because he won't let you get it. It's Ben Carter.
I definitely won't let you. Fuck's sake. I'm so sorry. That was really good. Oh.
There you go.
Very sorry about that slight bang for those joining us via audio. My mic arm detached.
Your mic dropped.
My mic dropped, yes. So there's some sort of, you know, weird energy in the room today. It's going to be a fun episode.
Yeah, it does feel a bit odd in here.
Yeah.
Really
I'm picking
weird.
Up on it. I'm picking up on it.
A bit of a vibe in here today. But before we get into a little bit of housekeeping, if you don't already, please follow us on our socials, at Could Murder a Pod on Instagram, on Twitter, and we've got a Facebook as well.
Very much like we did in Series 3, we are at some point going to have a vote for our Halloween episode of this series.
Yeah, we're going to let you guys decide for us, because for some reason we forgot again, and we need you to help us pick it.
So there you go. So get yourselves over to Instagram at Could Murder a Pod. We post stuff every day. We repost stuff every day as well, pretty much if we get enough people tagging us in stories. So tag us as well.
We post your stuff. We don't repost our stuff every day because that'd be mental.
That'd be horrible, yeah.
Yeah, it would be. And if you can't get enough of the content, we do have a Patreon. And over there, we have over 40 episodes in there now. Minisodes varying between 20 to 40 minutes in length, roundabout. Mm,
absolutely. And they're available on video and audio platforms. We've done some very big cases recently as well. So we've done the case of Raoul Moat, the Jonestown Massacre, the Dyatlov Pass, the case of Derek Bird, the Snapchat murders, all just to name a few.
That's too many,
right?
I feel intimidated to even go on there now.
Dearie me, well, it's going to get worse because we post new episodes on Patreon every single week.
What, do you guys just pick them then or something?
Well, let me stop you right there. No.
Oh.
We do votes.
That's exciting. So what, the audience can interact with us and pick the cases?
Lots of interaction, Tom. It gets a bit messy at times because there's so much going on over there, but, you know, stay on top of it. Yeah, and all episodes available on audio, available on video. It's just £1 a week. So sweet little deal there, I think.
But you're not even a patron. That's why I need
it. Wouldn't let me. I think make a new account and do it. I tried that.
If you really like it, why don't you do it? If you like it so much. Anyway, and if you guys want to support us in another way, we do have a merch store, which we have a hat, we have a mug, a pack of stickers, and a lovely bag, which your totes enjoy. Tote bag.
So yeah, we really hope everybody enjoyed last week's episode, the case of Fred and Rose West. We are back with another very British true crime case.
Yeah, the Fred and Rose one was a big case. It came second in our last year's vote for the case. We were beaten by JonBenet. So we knew you guys wanted it. There's been lots of requests for it. Thank you so much for all the lovely comments on that.
And this week, it's a case that was also frequently voted for in our poll for the previous series. It's the case of the White House Farm murders. And this one, Tom, I think it's possibly the most interesting case I've researched so far in terms of things going on and fingers being
ever
pointed. Yeah.
Oh, that's a very big claim. It's another bit of a mystery one, even though it's solved. Is it solved?
Yeah.
It's like the JonBenet one in terms of a slightly different episode this one, because we're kind of talking about theories and speculation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're looking forward to getting into that. And we've timed it either perfectly or terribly, because Louis Theroux has just produced a documentary all about this, which is being released on the day that we're filming this.
Yeah.
So we've not been able to watch that. So if he breaks the case in that, well, you know. Cheers, Louis.
So yeah, if you are discovering us from that particular series, how did Louis do? How are we doing? And, you know, from what we've read, Louis's very much pointing the finger of, who we'll go on to discuss, Jeremy Bamber's innocence. So we're going to go on to kind of paint a bit of a picture on all the individuals involved. Make up your own minds, guys. We're going to share our thoughts. So yeah, so we're going to take you through it. We're going to talk about all the members of the family, all of the key individuals involved in this case, and let you make your own minds up while we try and make our minds up, and producer Dan puts his mind to the test.
Boom, boom, boom.
How are you feeling about that, Dan?
Buzzing.
Well, let's get into the family history first, Ben, and kind of talk about each member of the family, a little bit about them, so we can set the scene.
So before we get onto the people, let's talk about the property. So the White House Farm is a farmhouse set amongst 300 acres of farmland in Tolles Hunt, Darcy, Essex. At the time of this particular case, the house belonged to June and Neville Bamber, and the 300 acres of land accompanying the property was farmland that the family actually owned and worked on. It's a massive, massive property, so it was not uncommon for extended family, friends to come and stay at the property, but they also had farm workers and housekeepers, so it was very often a busy setting, both internally and externally of the house. The whole case surrounds six key people who we're going to go on to talk about now.
All right, so Neville and June Bamber. Ralph Neville Bamber, known as Neville, was born on the 8th of June 1924. He was a farmer, local magistrate, and former RAF pilot.
Yeah, as Tom mentioned, former RAF pilot. He actually joined the Royal Air Force and flew mosquitoes in the North Africa during World War II. I had to Google those planes, and they are cool-looking planes.
Yeah?
Yeah, really cool-looking planes.
Annoying at a barbecue, though.
Neville would actually go on to break his back in an air crash during the war, and this resulted in a year spent in hospital.
Eesh.
So Neville, very well known and very well regarded in the local community. He was described as the perfect gentleman with a light-hearted character who enjoyed socialising.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in the local community would go to him if they had kind of questions, wanted some advice. He was kind of a very well-rounded, level-headed guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was...
Neville-headed guy.
Yep.
Sorry.
I was all right.
Early. Got a thumb up from Dan.
You don't apologise when you make a joke.
I know, but it was early and kind of jarring.
You do interrupt. Yeah, and people would go to him for advice, and you know, he was kind of a guy that would be happy to help.
And there is an ITV series called The White House Farm Murders, and the casting they have got for the guy that plays Neville, wow, spot on. So Neville would go on to meet his wife-to-be, June, during his early 20s, and the pair would go on to get married in 1949, both at the age of 25.
And June was actually born in June. The 3rd of June 1924. They were unable to have children themselves, which led them to later on adopt, which we'll get to that. And they were both very Christian, and she was particularly Christian,
very God-fearing,
and very kind of disciplined with their approach with that. June also suffered from depression, and she was treated in a psychiatric hospital in 1982. And during that time, she apparently got very aggressively into religion.
June would also play her part to help during the war. She went on to work in offices locally, but also would join the female army and navy, and was actually posted at one point to Calcutta. After the war, June became a homemaker and took part in community activities with her local church and Women's Institute, including Meals on Wheels. And as a couple, June and Neville loved to play tennis.
15, love that.
So June was also a very keen gardener. She liked to make arrangements in the local church, obviously, as Tom had mentioned, very, very heavily religious lady. She would actually be appointed a church warden later in life as well. The couple would actually go on to adopt two children from the Church of England's Children's Society. And the first one we're going to talk about is Sheila.
So Sheila, when she was born, she was actually called Phyllis Jean Caffell, and she was born the 18th of July, 1957. Her biological mother was 18 at the time, and she was called Christine, and she was actually the daughter of a senior chaplain to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Christine's father made her place her baby up for adoption, and in doing that, she went to the Church of England's Children's Society 2 weeks after the birth, and then Phyllis was adopted by the Bambers at 3 months old. The chaplain had known Neville in the RAF and selected the Bambers from a list of prospective adopters. And it seems the Bambers didn't like the name Phyllis, so they named her Sheila.
As a youngster, Sheila was very bright, regarded as a very bright child with aspirations of going on to be a model. However, she was also a gifted writer with a particular skill at writing short stories. So the Bambers were a very wealthy family, and they did send both of their adopted children to some very exclusive schools. So she went to a school in Eastbourne called Myra House. However, she was expelled from this school, and it's not clear as to why that happened. She then attended boarding school in Norwich and basically fell in love with the place, as she found it very easy to socialise, and this is kind of a theme that will run through Sheila's later life. But she basically made a lot of friends, settled into the school really quickly, and performed really well academically.
So Sheila would actually rebel under June quite a lot, obviously her being very religious and very kind of strict with her ways. And even, you know, kind of growing up, you like to rebel from your parents. And once June actually caught Sheila having sex with a farmhand in a field, and June would then refer to her as the devil's child, which is quite a firm thing there.
Powerful words.
As been mentioned, Sheila worked as a model in the world of fashion, and she went to Tokyo for a short period of time. But apparently her lifestyle, she wasn't able to keep up with it. So being very social, the money spent, and she even apparently allegedly dabbled in some drugs during that time as well. So even though she was getting paid fairly all right for this work, yeah, it kind of took her into places that maybe wasn't great for her. She also was suffering with some mental health difficulties as well. So the drugs taken as well, all combined together, wasn't the best for her.
So she's young, she's attractive, she's traveling the world, she's working as a model. She has got, you know, there is a slightly darker side to this in that she's been exposed to the world of drugs, and she has fought her own kind of mental health battles during that time. But the family very much have the plan for Sheila that she's going to marry a rich, eligible bachelor and go on to have a family of her own.
But although this was her parents' intentions, this didn't quite go to plan. At 17, Sheila found out she was pregnant by her then boyfriend, Colin Caffell, who was a penniless artist. And June and Neville, who obviously we've said very religious, they arranged for her to have an abortion. Following this abortion, Sheila returned to her studies but later decided to train to become a hairdresser.
So at the age of 20, Sheila again becomes pregnant with Colin, and this time the couple decide to marry, and they get married at Chelmsford Registry Office in May of 1977. However, this pregnancy would result in a miscarriage in the sixth month, and as a result, to support Sheila through this, Neville and June decided to purchase her a garden flat in Carlingford in Hampstead, so a very affluent area of London there, to basically allow her and Colin the time and space to recuperate.
So sadly, the couple would go on to suffer one more miscarriage before Sheila did become pregnant with twins, Daniel and Nicholas, who were born in June 1979. After the boys were born, Sheila lived off welfare and low-paid jobs such as cleaning and waitressing. But sadly, the couple would actually go on to divorce in May 1982 after reports of Colin cheating.
The difficulties in the relationship were having a profound effect on Sheila's mental health during this time, which would continue to decline. And on one occasion, Colin actually left Sheila's 21st birthday party with another woman, which resulted in Sheila needing hospital treatment after she smashed a window with her fist. So after the divorce as well, Neville and June bought Sheila another flat, this time in Moorshead Mansions, Maida Vale. And Colin would then go on to help raise the boys from his own home. So there was kind of a brief moment where the family would potentially suggest the boys go into kind of foster care and daycare, which obviously had a profound impact then again on Sheila, who was very much set on, these are my boys, I'm going to raise them.
Also, another thing to note, her ex-husband Colin, he wasn't a huge fan of her parents' effect they had on the children, being very religious, making the boys kneel and pray. He wasn't a fan of that at all. So he did get custody of the kids, but he did let Sheila see them. And the parents, you know, if she was going for an episode, would kind of prompt the idea of not complete foster put them to foster family, but even just for a day or two, just give her a bit of a break from the kids. But there's also a report from the social services, apparently, that Sheila did neglect the children and they had unexplained injuries, including burns and falls.
Yeah, this was a part that was very much argued, I think, again, during the later trial as well, because there's never any clear evidence of this. And it was suggested that she wasn't capable of that. But also there are people that say, no, you know, she smashed windows.
When we're doing the research for this, you basically... It's kind of very similar to the JonBenet case in regards to what you watch, what you listen to, who they think is guilty, and what information they might leave out, what information they might lean on more than others. So a lot of this, it can be, you can find this information in some places, not on others. So a lot of it is in the conjecture kind of category. So after the divorce, Sheila kind of wanted to start kind of a new life for herself. She made a new friendship group. She was given the playful nickname Bambi and became involved in partying, drugs, and older men. One of her waitressing jobs was at a place called School Dinners, where the waitresses dressed up as schoolgirls. Sheila's mental health did continue to decline, with episodes of banging her head against walls and becoming agitated to the point where one of her boyfriends feared for her safety. So she was referred to a psychiatrist at St. Andrew's Hospital in Northampton, and Ferguson, the doctor there, said she was in an agitated and psychotic state, diagnosing a schizoaffective disorder characterized by disturbance of thinking and perception. He said she was paranoid and believed the devil had taken her over and given her the power to project evil onto others, including her sons. She believed she could make them have sex and cause violence with her.
So yeah, Sheila actually did, in some close circles, refer to her twin boys as the devil's children, which was kind of a play on the fact of what June had referred to her as. So as Tom said, she was seeing a GP and at the time was prescribed some antipsychotic drugs.
So Dr. Ferguson would go on to say that apparently she did say she also believed she was capable of murdering them or getting them to kill others. And she spoke about suicide, though Dr. Ferguson did not regard her as a suicide risk. So yeah, there's lots to unpack there. And obviously just kind of shows what kind of mindset she was in. And also the fact that you imagine those kind of struggles she's having and mixing with crowds and taking certain drugs like cocaine, that kind of thing is going to be really detrimental.
Definitely. And keep this in mind as we go on to talk about what eventually would happen, but also keep it in mind in the context of when we go on to describe Jeremy's childhood and his upbringing. So in terms of Daniel and Nicholas Caffell, so there's not much to say about the twins. They were 6 years old at the time of what we're going to go on to discuss. They took a lot of joy in trying to kind of dupe people when they went up to them to say, which twin is which? Can you tell us apart? Who is who?
And they weren't identical twins, so it's really easy. So straight away, no, they were identical twins. That's why it worked.
It's just playing. So the twins very much disliked staying at the farm, partly due to obviously all of the kneeling and praying they were forced to do, but also the fact that Daniel had recently become a vegetarian and was worried about being forced to eat meat on the farm.
Good, Daniel boy!
So now we're going to go on to talk about Jeremy Bamber, the lead figure in this case.
So Jeremy Neville Bamber was born Jeremy Paul Marsham on the 13th of January 1961. His biological parents were Juliet Dorothy Wheeler, who was a vicar's daughter, who had an affair with a married sergeant major in the British Army, Leslie Bryan Marsham. And Marsham eventually became a controller at Buckingham Palace.
So the couple gave up Jeremy for adoption to the Church of England Children's Society when he was just 6 weeks old. His biological parents would later marry and had other children. And as Tom said, his father would become a senior member of staff at Buckingham Palace. You can only imagine knowing that you've been put up for adoption to then see your biological parents go on and have another family, that must leave you with a slight sense of, I guess, rejection and perhaps even some abandonment issues.
Definitely. Neville and June Bamber sent him to Gresham School, a boarding school in Norfolk, and then college in Colchester. He wasn't a big fan of going to the boarding school, but he was made to go there. So Neville and June were very open to him with the fact that he was adopted, and he told close mates about it when he was at school. But as cruel as children can be, they kind of spread that around, and then he was actually being bullied, and they were calling him the bastard.
So Jeremy would actually be described by the headmaster of the school as a loner, not popular, but also sharp-tongued. So although he was being bullied and although they were being, you know, very unfriendly to him, he still had, he always had to get the last word, it seemed. And this is something that kind of, it's the opposite to Sheila in terms of she was loving school, she was loving boarding school, she was having a very good social life. Jeremy a bit more closed off.
I'd always take that with a pinch of salt though. They interview a headmaster of a school which had lots and lots of children at, and they're asking their opinion of him, and they're not going to go, he was a breath of fresh air. they're going to say the kind of negative little things and how much the interaction that she had with the kid.
Yeah.
You always have to take it with a pinch of salt because it's just feeding into the narrative.
Outside of school, when he was back on the farm, he used to torment his God-fearing mother with rats. So apparently she was petrified of rats, and Jeremy would catch them on the farm and bring them into the farmhouse just to torment her.
So as the headmaster said, which might not be true, the fact that he was a bit of a loner, he got very into his music, maybe as some form of escape, and very into the new romantic kind of style. And he would even apparently work on the farm dressed in his new romantic gear, just to kind of irk his parents and maybe a bit shock factor for people seeing him driving around in a tractor dressed in his new romantic clobber.
Definitely. So he was very much one for rebelling and that kind of counterculture movement that Tom referenced. But you've also got to think in his head, he's been put up for adoption almost immediately, 6 weeks. Then his adoptive parents have sent him off to boarding school straight away. So he's got to be...
Well, not only 6 weeks.
Well, not yeah, that would have been... imagine that.
The teacher got... He was a handful in class.
From his side of things, he might feel a sense of... No sense of belonging.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, as you said, he's been rejected by your birth parents and then essentially parents trying to mould you into their religious ways, which if you don't agree with, you kind of feel like you're being forced into this. And then, yeah, they send you off to another school. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, it must be very hard to kind of deal with that being moved about as much as he was. He did leave school with no qualifications, which displeased Neville, but managed to pass 7 O-levels at sixth form college in Colchester. So he apparently was clever. He just couldn't
really be bothered.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
His rebellious nature would very much continue into his teenage years. He actually ended up growing and selling weed on the farm, very much to his mother's dislike.
Was growing some Mary Jane?
So mother absolutely chastised him for that. And as we said, extended family members would regularly visit the farm. Jeremy's cousins would describe him as a spoilt brat who would sulk for hours if he didn't get his way. He was also a nasty piece of work and got joy from allegedly abusing animals on the farm. Again, according to his cousins and school friends, Jeremy was sexually abused by older boys at the boarding school.
Yeah, a lot of the documentaries you find, there's one particular cousin who seems to pop up in them. And he's got a very negative opinion of Jeremy. So Jeremy would go on to set up home in the cottage at 9 Head Street, Goldhanger, which is 3.5 miles away from the parents' farmhouse. But Neville owned the cottage and Bamba lived there rent-free. It took 5 minutes to drive by car from the cottage to the parents' home and by bicycle 15 minutes at least. So yeah, he was on the grounds. If he did hate his parents as much, you would have thought that he would move away. Yeah, he was living on the grounds there rent-free, and Jeremy apparently hated the farm. His father's will cut him off unless he stayed a farmer.
There you go. And I think around this time would have been when Sheila was getting her flats bought in kind of exclusive areas of London. So he's very, very envious of that. The model lifestyle that she was living. He used to go with her to London on some occasions and kind of hang in that, that high society group of people.
The reason why Neville actually gave the fact that he sent Jeremy away to boarding school was the fact that he felt it inappropriate for Jeremy to go to a local school with the village children, because one day he might have to employ them on his farm. So that's like, at least it gives a bit of context there. It's not just sending them away.
Yeah.
But that is very much going from a young age. You're going to be doing this job when you grow up. This is going to be your future.
Here's one for you though, Tom.
Go on.
Jeremy's cousins, you know, they've said a lot about him already, but they would also refer to him as the cuckoo. Do you know why?
Please tell me, and please tell the audience, Ben.
Allegedly because cuckoo birds lay their eggs in other birds' nests, forcing other birds to essentially raise the cuckoo. The more you know. Jeremy's local and favourite drinking spot was called the Frog and Bean Pub, and Jeremy drank here for free because he gave the owners potatoes from the farm. So if there are any pub owners listening to the podcast right now, big fans of true crime.
He probably gave them some weed as well, so probably had some baked potatoes there as well. Or mash?
Hash.
Or hash? Hash potato?
So as Tom mentioned, Jeremy, you know, if he didn't remain working on the farm, Neville had allegedly threatened to cut him from the will. So very much the plan for Jeremy here was where Sheila, they were hoping, would go off and marry rich. They wanted Jeremy to very much continue to work, continue to graft. And I think they were trying to kind of shake out that kind of new romantic, rebellious streak in him. But they didn't have a lot of luck.
So that's the scene set. You've got the two adopted children there, both with their own issues. Sheila with mental health issues, Jeremy with his own issues about abandonment and also feeling forced in the situation, having to remain at the farm. But we're going to go into the timeline now and deal what happened on the fateful night. The 4th of August 1985, Sheila Cathell, the adoptive daughter of Neville and June Bamber, arrives at White House Farm with her sons, Daniel and Nicholas. She was seen to be behaving normally. The two farm workers and the housekeeper noticed nothing unusual about her visit. They even said that she seemed happy. Sheila planned to stay for the week before returning to her home in Maida Vale.
So the 6th of August 1985, Jeremy Bamber arrives at the farm. He lived only a 5-minute drive away from his parents in a cottage that was owned by his parents. During this visit, Neville and June suggested to Sheila that the boys be placed in daytime foster care with a family local to White House Farm. Sheila did not seem bothered by the suggestion, as she would rather stay in London. The boys had been in foster care before, so it wasn't a shock to Sheila. So this is very much the opinion and story of Jeremy Bamber at the time, stating that the whole family were kind of for the idea of the grandchildren to be placed into foster care while Sheila continued to recover. And he's saying that there was no repercussion of this suggestion.
So now we're going to move into times of that day. So 9:30 p.m, a farm worker heard Jeremy or someone leave. Around this time, Barbara Wilson, the farm secretary, phoned Neville and noticed his usual even temper was amiss. She had the feeling that she had interrupted an argument. Around 10 p.m, June's sister phoned and spoke to Sheila, who she thought seemed quiet, then to June, who seemed normal.
So between the hours of 12 a.m. and 3 p.m, which is an estimation, there is a struggle at the farmhouse. Neville Bamber is shot 8 times, 6 times to the head and face. Shots seem to have been fired when the rifle was a few inches from his skin. He is shot 4 times upstairs. The remaining shots are fired in the kitchen, including the fatal shot. There are 2 wounds to Neville's right side and 2 to the top of his head, which would probably have resulted in unconsciousness. The left side of his lip was wounded, his jaw was fractured, and his teeth, neck, and larynx were damaged. So Neville's injuries included black eyes and a broken nose, linear bruising to the cheeks, lacerations to the head, linear type bruising to the right forearm, bruising to the left wrist and forearm, and 3 circular burn type marks to the back at the top of his spine. The linear marks were consistent with Neville having been struck with a long, blunt object, possibly a gun. So notably, and we'll go on to describe the rest of the scene, Neville has very much been on the receiving end of the worst beating, either before or after he was murdered. And one thing that we wanted to talk about earlier is that Neville was a very large stature.
Yeah, he's very tall.
Very tall. Obviously, military background can probably fend for himself, but he has received quite a drastic beating there.
June is shot 7 times, 1 shot to her forehead between her eyes, and this was fired from under a foot away. That and another shot to the right side of her head caused her a quick death. There were also shots to the right side of her lower neck, her right forearm, and 2 injuries on the right side of her chest and right knee. She died in her nightdress, lying on the floor by the door of the master bedroom. Sheila's sons, Daniel and Nicholas, were shot whilst in bed in Sheila's childhood bedroom. Daniel had been shot 5 times in the back of the head, 4 times with the gun held within 1 foot of his head, and once from over 2 feet away. Nicholas had been shot 3 times, all contact or close proximity shots. One of the boys was still sucking his thumb when he died. And there's a famous image from this room. It's carved into the cupboard. It says, "I hate this place." Sheila also died in the master bedroom. She was shot 2 times under the chin, one of them in her throat, which would have eventually killed her. However, she was also shot at closer range. The second shot hit her brain, killing Sheila instantly. So obviously this is how all the bodies were found, and it's estimated this all happened between 12 and 3 a.m. But there's a lot of different theories about exactly what happened with Sheila and when. So the timeline, it does kind of, as we said before, there's lots of different ideas about this case and exactly what happened. So the timeline we're following here will point out when there's slight differences in certain people's opinions.
Yeah, and most people believe that there's no possibility of an outside or kind of external culprit, and that very much it's either Jeremy or Sheila. So again, it keep that in mind. But there's, yeah, as Tom said, lots and lots of conjecture. So on the 7th of August 1985 at 3:26 a.m, Jeremy Bamber rang Chelmsford local police station, not the 999 number, but he actually would have called them directly, so imagine like getting that out of a yellow pages or something like that. He called to report that his father Neville had just phoned frantically to say that Sheila was going berserk with a semi-automatic rifle. Jeremy said that the line then went dead in the middle of the call.
So 3:56 a.m, a British telecom operator checked the White House Farm line and found that the line was open. The operator could hear a dog barking. Jeremy drove to the farmhouse, as did three officers from Witham Police Station, who noticed that Jeremy had been driving much more slowly than them. They passed him and arrived at the farmhouse 1 or 2 minutes before him. He was known to be a fast driver. The group waited outside the house for the tactical firearms unit to arrive. So on that, the documentary I was watching, which was very much Jeremy was guilty, they were saying it's strange he was driving slowly, but if he's driving to a place where someone's got a gun, I can understand him waiting for the police to overtake him and then go there. I completely understand that. And when the police arrived there, to our US listeners, the UK police, they're not armed. They need special units, firearms units, to come in with the firearms. So the police would arrive there, hearing that what this the disturbance was, and it was firearm related. So they'd have to call for backup then. And there's also reports that they came in, they saw lights being turned on in the house when they were waiting outside of it.
Yeah, and they could see a figure kind of moving between different rooms.
So they thought someone's around in the house who's just, committed murder. They're not going to walk in there completely unarmed to deal with it. So they had to wait for the tactical firearms unit to arrive, and it did take them a fair while to get there.
And also they're going off of the information that Jeremy has shared, which is that Sheila was potentially going berserk with the rifle, which also meant that if they have an active shooter present in the house, they wanted to be obviously prepared before kind of entering that environment.
So while waiting outside, the police questioned Jeremy, who seemed calm. He told them about the phone call from his father and that it sounded as though someone had cut him off. He said he did not get along with his sister, and when asked whether she might have gone berserk with a gun, he replied, "I don't know, really. She is a nutter. She's been having treatment." Jeremy told them Sheila was familiar with guns and they had gone target shooting together. He told the police he was at the house the night before and had loaded the rifle because he thought he had heard rabbits outside. He then left it on the kitchen table, fully loaded, with a box of ammunition nearby. Again, I listened to a podcast, an American podcast, about this case, and they were kind of saying how guns are treated very differently over here in the UK as it is in America. In America, they tend to, because a lot more people have guns, they'll lock them away or be very kind of careful with it. In the UK, it's very much the opposite. There's not many people that have guns, and when people do, it tends to be more, it's quite normal for farming communities to have guns. And it would be seen as, the gun itself apparently wasn't, it's a 22 rifle, which apparently, it sounds like you clap in your hand. It's not known to be like a really lethal weapon. It's just killing rabbits and whatnot. So it being left to one side, Jeremy, maybe he didn't know that the kids and were coming over or whatever, but it wasn't a big deal for him leaving it out there. It's not been just touted as that was a really big concern. It's also been said by Colin, the husband of Sheila, that she had no experience with guns whatsoever.
Yeah.
If anything, she was quite anti-guns. But apparently the 22 caliber, it doesn't give you much recoil when you shoot, as in it's very easy to shoot, so it doesn't make your hand move. So shooting a target, it's very simple to do. And also with the injuries that we described already, a lot of them are done at very, very close range. So it's been said that that kind of gun would be very easy for anyone who hasn't shot before to use in a lethal manner.
Yeah, and this is what, the mid-80s, the middle of the countryside, Essex. There's not a lot of incidents like this would ever take place. So the local police that did arrive, very likely that they hadn't had previous training to deal with a particular matter like this. And obviously that's caused then a delay for the firearms team to arrive. And this is exactly what they do at 5 a.m. Tactical firearms arrive, but decide to wait until daylight before trying to enter. Without knowing the house and with a potential suspect with a gun on the loose, they deemed it too dangerous to enter until there is sunlight. So again, this is where they may have witnessed shadowy figures kind of moving from room to room, different lights going off. I guess it's hard to say unless you're in that situation, but Jeremy, knowing that's his family, and this is now an hour or so into waiting outside, what you would do in that situation, whether you would want to run in and try and talk her down if he believes it to be Sheila, it's hard to say. During this time, police determined that all the doors and windows to the house were shut except for the window in the main bedroom on the first floor. Using a loudhailer, they spent 2 hours trying to communicate with Sheila, but to no avail. Some reports suggest that there was movement within the house, though this is still unconfirmed.
So 7:54 a.m, the police entered the farmhouse, breaking in the back door with a sledgehammer. They noticed that the door had been locked from the inside, the key still in the lock. They entered and found the bodies, counting 25 shots had been fired, mostly at close range. Inside the house, a telephone was lying on one of the kitchen surfaces with its receiver off the hook, next to empty cartridge cases, just where Jeremy had said he had left boxes of ammunition the night before. The chairs and stools were overturned, and there's broken crockery, a broken ceiling light, and what looked like blood on the floor. They found Sheila upstairs, a 22 caliber rifle was lying across her chest, pointing up at her neck, with her right hand resting lightly on it. June's Bible lay on the floor beside Sheila, partly resting on her upper right arm. It was normally kept in a bedside cupboard.
Yeah, so perhaps they're playing on the deeply religious kind of family themes, or if it's someone trying to stage it to look like that, at least. So it's a very, very messy, very, very violent scene that they've stumbled on.
Yeah, and like you said, this kind of thing is not really normal in most places, but around this kind of quiet place and very kind of well-to-do, it was very shocking for the police to kind of come across such a scene. Sheila had a long documented history of illness, and it seemed clear to the police that she had shot her parents, children, and then finally herself. Given Jeremy's reported phone call from Neville, this seemed like the most likely scenario, an open and shut case. And that is very much not what it turned out to be.
So based on police believing Jeremy, first of all, but also investigating the scene for a very short period of time, they kind of jumped to the conclusion that, yes, right, Sheila, this is a murder-suicide. She's had stuff going on. Jeremy's saying she's a nutter, I believe was the quote. This must be what happened. So they very quickly come to the conclusion that it's a solved case, and therefore much of the crime scene was destroyed, including the removal and burning of blood-stained carpets and beddings at Jeremy's request, as this seemed like a cut-and-dry case. So crime scene 101. Secure the scene.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Maintain the evidence.
Yeah. Again, this kind of reeks of the JonBenet case in regards to just lack of knowledge of how to deal with a crime scene, lack of experience with it. Apparently, lots of people entered the house. I think it reported like over 50 people went in the house during this time. And also, certain things just were never retrieved or destroyed. I believe the Bible was destroyed as well. That was found on her. And also, if you look closely at the picture of the Bible, there seems to be a note sticking out from the top of it, which has been, it's been alleged that could possibly be Sheila's suicide note. But we'll get on to that. When Jeremy was interviewed at the scene of the crime, he appeared genuinely distressed and was comforted by an officer and given tea and whiskey. I remember one of the documentaries I was watching on it, he apparently fell to his knees and looked like he was trying to make himself sick, or rather than, like, he thought this is how I should be acting rather than what he felt. He said he seemed quite cold and didn't seem to be as shook up as you would imagine if this was to happen. Obviously, like we said many times before, people deal with grief in different ways. Mm. You can't say that you have to deal with it a certain way, but he seemed quite stoic in that time, and then eventually, then suddenly switched to being like kind of very physical with his emotion.
Yeah, and I mean, perhaps that can be consistent with the type of character he had, the way we've kind of described his childhood and his adolescence. He was very kind of a much of a loner, wasn't as animated, apart from when he went kind of new romantic on the tractor. Really, really bizarre set of circumstances at the moment. And over the next few days, as the investigation progressed, it unveiled an inconsistency with the reported murder weapon. So first of all, the rifle itself, without a silencer, the 25 shots that were fired that night would have made far too much noise and would have alerted other victims to the danger. Yet if a silencer was attached to the weapon, it would have made the rifle too long for Sheila to have shot herself with it, which had been assumed from the start of investigating the crime scene.
So with that as well, obviously the weapon was found without the silencer on it.
Yeah.
So in regards to, if Sheila, I don't think Sheila shot herself, then put it away, and then died. This podcast I listened to, they were saying that that noise of the 20 caliber, it can be very muffled, especially if you're done close up to someone. It's not, it's more like a...
thinking of a cap gun noise.
Yeah, I think it's not hugely different to that. We're not gun guys.
22 but, rifle though, that sounds big.
What, the word rifle you're going off there?
No, the 22 part. 22 caliber rifle sounds powerful.
Sounds powerful to someone who knows nothing about guns, i.e. me and you. But from this podcast of people who own guns, they said it's not.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably go with them instead of me.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay.
So yeah, the silencer, we will get to that because it does kind of twist and turn this case, and that does come into play later on.
Yeah, I hate to go back to the ITV series on this as well, but that moment when they realise that, well, first of all, the discovery of the silencer is a big deal, but when they recreate the investigators realising that the silencer would have made it too long for Sheila, they basically go into a forensic lab, find the shortest kind of woman or most similar woman to the height of Sheila, put the silencer on and go, there you go, shoot yourself. And she can't do it. It's a really, really well-made scene. Very poignant.
So basically they came to the realisation that if a silencer was used, it would have to have been taken off the weapon and moved after the killing. So that immediately is put doubt in people's minds whether Sheila had committed this crime, if the gun was loud enough to make everyone aware. But obviously the children were asleep. Yeah, it is a lot of kind of different theories that can run along there.
People that still to this day believe in that Jeremy is innocent, believe that she's obviously, Sheila is responsible, but that she used the silencer on the parents and on the grandchildren and then removed it, placed it in the cupboard and then took her own life without the silencer, which technically would have been achievable.
So 10th of August 1985, members of the Bambas' extended family visited the farm with Basil Cock. The estate's... Really?
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
The 10th of August 1985, members of the Bambas' extended family visited the farm with Basil Cock, the estate's executor. Neville Bamber's nephew, David Boutflower, found a silencer in a cupboard at the farm, still with traces of Sheila's blood on it alongside a single grey hair. In the cupboard where it was found, they also found the sights which had been removed with a screwdriver from the murder weapon. This discovery was witnessed by more than four people. The family then took the silencer to the farm secretary's home to examine it. They then told the police, who collected the silencer on the 12th of August. So the hair found in the silencer was apparently lost before it was taken to the Forensic Science Service at Huntingdon. So the thing there is, they found this silencer, and this is where, again, I've massively been swayed by listening to certain podcasts, but they found the silencer. They start thumbing their way all over it. Hmm. They then take it to the examiner person, the farm secretary's home to examine it.
Mm-hmm.
But why are they examining it?
Yeah, what qualifications has this secretary got?
Yeah, so it's like, but then what? They wait 2 days before they actually tell the police. So why are they doing that?
Yeah, that's a long period of time. Yeah. So the burns at the top of Neville's spine, which were quite unusual, perfectly circular, were consistent with that of a silencer having been shot and then kind of held and burnt onto him. If you imagine poking someone in the back to move them with a gun that's just been shot. So the 16th of August 1985, Jeremy attends Neville, June and Sheila's funeral in full view of the media. So there are some very famous photos here of him in absolute agony by the look of it, really grieving. Sheila's sons had a private funeral. Jeremy is seen being comforted by his girlfriend, Julie Mugford. He walked solemnly behind the coffins, visibly devastated, with his hand covering his face for the majority of the proceedings.
Yeah, so with the pictures, and it does look like Jeremy is very sad here. I do think there's a lot of this case which feels very Menendez brothers.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
With the kind of putting on a show, with the ideas of how Jeremy's, what we'll go into it, how he behaves. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some like links between that here. Some bodies language experts have pointed to the public display of sadness at this point by Jeremy to show signs of insincerity, covering his face and noticing the over-dramatic emotions not quite reaching all of the muscles in his face. It's like when people smile a fake smile, they don't smile with their eyes. They look dead behind the eyes. Yeah, like Dan's doing it right now. Or when Ben says a joke, I go, yes.
I don't know about that.
The producer Danny says it, and I'm like, what? You mean it? But yeah, it again, with the body language thing, I obviously that's their profession. I'm not slagging it off. But people grieve in different ways. Though that nephew, the one I mentioned earlier, and the one that found the silencer, he said, really, he's very odd with how he describes things.
Yeah.
He was saying about how, you know, he was seen very sad, and then he walked around the corner away from the cameras, and suddenly he had a great big smile on his face. He's going to went from here to here and didn't need to go in that much detail.
No, that's too much detail. Yeah. It's kind of, again, similar to the alleged Menendez brothers joke in the car.
The shoes.
Yeah. Yeah, very. After his family's funeral, Jeremy went out for a meal with friends. Some have suggested to celebrate. Detective Inspector Miller was watching Jeremy Bamber throughout the funeral, and he said that he knew immediately that something was wrong, and he thought that Jeremy was acting. He then got a call from Jeremy's former housemaster, William Thomas, who told Miller, "It seemed to me that Bamber was acting. My wife, who was watching the television with me at the time, also made comments about it." A lot of people believing that Bamber was kind of playing up to the cameras there. Again, you get very much the Menendez brothers vibes here. In the meantime, Bamber would go on to enjoy a life of luxury, spending his parents' money and even going on holiday to Amsterdam. And although his behaviour was now being closely watched, Bamber appeared unaffected and detached from the events at the farm.
Well, yeah, again, to make Menendez brothers doing the same thing, big spending spree after their parents passed away, that immediately made people ask questions. And yeah, again, it's like, it seems to be very an odd way to grieve losing all your family. So the 7th of September 1985, Julie Mugford changed her police statement. So Julie Mugford was Bamber's girlfriend. She had previously stated that she had received a telephone call from him at 3:30 a.m. on the 7th of August, during which he sounded worried and said, "There's something wrong at home." She said that she had been tired and had not asked what it was. You would ask what it was.
Yeah.
She now told police how Jeremy had planned and executed the murders, revealing that he had previously spoken about his desire to get rid of them all, and that on the 6th of August he had mentioned the family inheritance that he would inherit and said it was tonight or never. He then allegedly had previously spoken about hiring a hitman for £2,000. She also told the police that at approximately 9:50 p.m. on Tuesday, August 6th, the day Jeremy went for dinner at his parents' with Sheila and the boys, Jeremy had called her to say that he'd been thinking about committing the murders all day. She stated that his conversations about killing his family became frequent between October and December 1984 and into late 1985. He had spoken to her about shooting his entire family and escaping through a kitchen window. She also told police Bamber had said that he had got his friend, a man named Matthew McDonald, to kill the family.
So the important thing to note here is that when she decided to change her police statement, Jeremy had just broken up with her.
Yes.
So until that point, she'd either gone along with him or she'd, you know, stuck by him and genuinely believed he was innocent.
Yeah, so this is a huge part of the case because, yeah, this is essentially someone saying that, you know, literally he's told me he's going to do it and he's done it. As Ben mentioned, he's just broken up with her. Apparently, she took the breakup very badly. There's reports apparently of her trying to smother him afterwards, which immediately, you know, is a red flag there. Apparently, the police had some charges on her as well for some from drug selling and things like that. Some people theorise that perhaps she's given this information in order to help those charges go away. Seems very calm about learning all this from Bamber, and then suddenly it's like, okay, now I'm gonna tell the police everything. You could argue the fact that she's done it is because she was scared about Bamber beforehand, and now she wants, you know, to kind of set the story straight, but it does seem very
out of the blue.
Yeah, and even like if someone's saying to you they were thinking about killing their family, you would have thought you'd alert the police.
Yeah, or the family.
Prior. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's widely believed that her position towards Jeremy changed when an old girlfriend of his phoned him and he asked her out in Mugford's presence. As a result of this, the couple had an argument. She threw something at him, slapped him, and he twisted her arm up her back. So yeah, so very heated moment there. And perhaps that's the reason why Mugford is suddenly trying to kind of change her story. And it's also believed that she potentially, as a result of missing out on some of the inheritance now by being Jeremy's partner, she was going to miss out on a decent amount of money. So she then started also to talk to the tabloids. I believe there was a £25,000 deal that she had signed to sell her story. So yeah, not a great thing to do before anything has even gone to trial.
But also with Jeremy, if he's such an evil mastermind, why is he telling her all of this and then dumping her? That's the big thing there for me. It's like if you're confiding someone all this information, you wouldn't be doing that to someone who you're then planning you're going to dump, thinking that they're going to keep it secret. If there's no gain for them in this situation whatsoever.
8th of September 1985. As a result of Mugford's statement, Jeremy was arrested, as was the friend Mugford mentioned, though the friend had a solid alibi and was released. Jeremy told police Mugford was lying because he had broken up with her. Jeremy was bailed from the police station on the 13th of September and then went on holiday to the south of France. Before leaving England, he returned to the farmhouse, gaining entry by the downstairs bathroom window. He said that he did this because he had left his keys in London and needed some papers for the trip to France. He chose not to borrow keys from the housekeeper who lived nearby. So that is a little bit suspicious. So there's a hinged window. in the downstairs bathroom that apparently would not completely lock from the inside, so you could get in quite easily that way. But also deciding not to kind of go to the housekeeper who had keys to the property, considering he also wants to distance himself from the property. Maybe he's just wanted to go in under the radar, I guess, and not cause a fuss. But
yeah,
it's a little bit strange.
Yeah, it's a bit strange, but... Yeah, I mean, some people just have a odd way of thinking about it in terms of, like, sometimes people think, oh, it's easier if I just do this. But yeah, it could be as innocent as that, but it does look very, yeah, very suspect. On the 29th of September 1985, Jeremy returns from his trip to the south of France and is immediately rearrested and charged with all five murders.
On the 14th of October 1986, Jeremy Bamber's trial begins at the Chelmsford Crown Court. Bamber's ex-girlfriend, Julie Mugford, is the star witness. Justice Drake is appointed as judge. So during the trial, there were two explanations presented for the killings. The first was the prosecution case that Jeremy had entered the White House farm that night and shot the five members of his family with a legally held rifle. Sheila's blood was inside the silencer of the murder weapon, proving that she could not have shot herself, then put it in a cupboard downstairs. The second explanation put forward by the defense was that Sheila, who had a known history of mental health issues, had shot the four members of her family with the rifle and then committed suicide, just as the police had originally thought. Some officers on the scene, however, thought that some of the findings were inconsistent with this explanation and that members of the Bamber's extended family did not believe that it was consistent with their knowledge of Sheila. Despite mounting evidence, Bamber remained confident that he would leave court a free man.
As I said, there's so much conflicting information here, and being on the jury for that would be, yeah, it was very hard for them. They were unable to reach majority, which we'll get into. But it seems to be two theories there. There were certain bits of evidence which they weren't able to use in this in the courtroom, which is apparently very key bits of evidence.
Yeah. Well, they'd burnt most of it.
Exactly, yeah. So that immediately makes it not going to be a completely fair and free trial. On the 28th of October 1986, Jeremy Bamber was convicted of five counts of murder by a majority of 10-2 following a 19-day trial. So doing a majority is not a normal thing over here. So the judge wanted to close the case. He went with majority rather than, you know, the it has to be unanimous. He was sentenced to life imprisonment with recommendation that he serve a minimum of 25 years. After the sentencing, Mr. Justice Drake said, "I find it difficult to foresee whether it will ever be safe to release someone who can shoot two little boys as they lie asleep in their beds." He also noted that the problems had taken place during initial inquiries and throughout the main police investigations. The first major error in this case was the police allowing the house to be cleared shortly after the killings. Jeremy's fingerprints were eventually discovered in the Bible and the gun left on Sheila's body, but were missed during the initial inquiries. So the fingerprints on the gun, he had taken it out or got it prepared, ready to shoot rabbits, as he said, so that explains his fingerprints there. On the Bible...
We'll never know.
Yeah, I mean, there could be a number of reasons why he's touched that Bible. Yeah, that does seem a bit suspect, but as well, it's like, yeah, as the judge mentioned, there's a lot of police errors in this case.
Definitely, and apparently the judge also spoke to the jury and said, basically, either Mugford or Bamber are lying. It's your job to decide who is, and then that is what you base your ruling on. So November of 1986, Jeremy's first appeal was started just 1 month after he was found guilty. As Bamber believed that the judge had misdirected the jury, this appeal was heard but refused. During a later hearing with three appeal court judges in 1989, Bamber's lawyer Jeffrey Rivlin argued that the judge's summing up had been biased against Bamber. He claimed that the language the judge had used in the trial had been too forceful and that he undermined Bamber's defense by creating his own theory. As much as Rivlin claimed that the trial had not been fair, the judges refused Bamber's appeal as they believed there was nothing unsatisfactory in the verdicts. And interestingly, this lawyer that Bamber hires, Jeffrey Rivlin, would later go on to represent Saddam Hussein.
But he also had a theory on one of the things I watched that to do with Neville passing away, and apparently 10 or so other people who were from the army background and linked to him had previously died in mysterious circumstances in a certain period of time as well. Mm-hmm. So he had a much bigger conspiracy theory in terms of what actually could have happened that night in that place. But he didn't really go divulge much more than that. So it's just another theory put out there by him. 24th of September 1993, Jeremy petitioned the Home Secretary seeking a reference to the Court of Appeal. During consideration of the petition, the Home Office declined to disclose to the appellant expert evidence that he had obtained. Essex police work during the initial investigation had come under fire throughout Jeremy's trial, and this led to an internal inquiry. Bamber filed a complaint as he claimed that the results from the inquiry proved that the police had withheld evidence during his trial. His complaint was investigated and it uncovered further documents that had not been seen before. On the 25th of July 1994, the petition was refused despite the new evidence. See, that's very, very odd. Like, why wouldn't you want to look into it? I know the police have come under a lot of fire and they don't want to go on to prove, oh, we've arrested a guilty man for this long.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's how the courts aren't going, well, yeah, we need to look into that. If there's new evidence come to light, we need to look into it.
I'm thinking more it's along the lines of, although again, this is just an opinion, that they've made a mistake and they don't want to kind of look back on that.
Yeah.
That's the vibe I kind of get. So February of 1996, the Essex police destroyed many of the original trial exhibits. It might have been necessary for the court to examine the circumstances in which this had happened at any subsequent appeals. So again, this again looks like some sort of cover-up. They're going back to remove any possibility to re-examine evidence. The police officer responsible contended that it was done without his appreciating that there was any ongoing legal process that might require the further use of the exhibits. However, during legal arguments, it was agreed that the court could protect Jeremy's position by making assumptions in his favour, and that, therefore, it was unnecessary to resolve precisely how this came about.
So basically, they destroy this evidence thinking, oh, we'll never need it. We'll make some room in the evidence room. And then they're going, well, no, don't. Why did you do that? Going, oh, well, like your parents trying to get rid of your old toys. You're never going to use it. It's like, I might. But yeah, they just destroy an evidence. Or that's the kind of thing in this case which really does make you lean on the idea of going, it's not quite as cut and dry.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to say. They're trying to hide their mistakes, trying to hide this stuff, and just seem to be, because it's done by the police, they're like, oh, well, no, it's fine. April 1997, Jeremy's case was treated as still alive and was effectively transferred to the commission to complete the review.
So July of 2001, a team of police officers were given 4 months to complete fresh inquiries into the case. It was referred back to the Court of Appeal by Criminal Cases Review Commission, which investigates possible miscarriages of justice because of the discovery of DNA inside the silencer. This was found as a result of a test not available in 1986 and constituted fresh evidence. So it's kind of, I guess, the UK's version of the Innocence Project type of thing. So this appeal ended up working against Jeremy, and in a 522 paragraph judgment, the judges concluded that there was no conduct on the part of the investigators that threatened the integrity of the trial. If anything, it made them agree with the jury's decision even more.
And in 2008, Jeremy appealed his whole life sentence but lost, and the verdict was upheld in 2009. Bamber and three other British whole life prisoners appealed to the European Court of Human Rights, but the appeal was rejected in 2012. So we can appreciate, obviously, there's a lot to digest there, lots of different theories going on. We've mentioned a lot of the kind of things that made Jeremy appear innocent or guilty, as the same with Sheila. We're going to go a bit more in depth now about those things there, which can really sway the jury, essentially.
Yeah. Have you got a suspect in mind at this point, Dan?
I think it reeks of Jeremy, but...
Oh. Well, let's see if Tom can change your mind.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward to this.
Why me change your mind?
Well, you might not have to.
What are you going to be doing for the next 20 minutes?
I'm just going to be...
farting away. Play the clip.
Just let me.
You're outside about 20 minutes.
Fuck off.
Perfect.
That would probably work quite well, but don't.
So Dan, you're currently saying it reached Jeremy. Ben, what's your theory currently?
I don't think there was enough to convict him. I do think he's either very, very smart or he's very, very unlucky. But I don't think it was Sheila at the same time. And I don't think it was June or Neville or either the boys.
I must add, could I watch the footage of the funeral as well? And it does seem a little bit fishy. You know, I'm not an actor. But
a bit OTT.
A bit kind of insincere.
Yeah, so me looking into it, I at first was thinking that Jeremy was innocent, but then some of the things with the silencer and whatnot we're going to get into, it does appear very bizarre.
Yeah, I'm still leaning more towards guilty, but I think he had a very unfair trial.
Yeah, Neville's injuries are probably the main thing making me think that it was Jeremy.
Although it's believed he was shot upstairs and then made to go downstairs and then shot downstairs. Although she was going for, she'd never been violent with anyone before. She'd smashed
but
a couple
the
of
burn
windows.
Marks on the back. Could that be not marching them downstairs?
Could be.
With a gun to the back. Anyway, we're going to go through reasons why Sheila, these are some theories to back her innocence. So the first of the gunshot wounds hit her in the throat, and it would be possible for a person with such an injury to stand up and walk around, as initially suggested. However, the lack of blood on Sheila's nightdress suggested she had not gotten up and walked around after she had been shot the first time.
As well as this, she had very naturally long nails, and they were perfectly intact. So yeah, any kind of reloading of the gun or recoil from the gun would have absolutely cracked the nails, but they were in pristine condition. At the time of her body being discovered, and also the soles of her feet completely clean, completely spotless. So hard to believe she would have been walking around different rooms of the house.
Dear Stanley Brian Jones, who worked in the case, claims the scene was immediately treated as four murders and a suicide because the team had a note saying, "I've killed myself," but the policeman who seized it later failed to include any reference to it in his statement, and later when it re-emerged, it was filed away as illegible. There's also been claims that we mentioned before about Neville being 6'4" and healthy. How would Sheila, with such a small stature, be able to claim his life and, you know, overpower him? Obviously, she's got a weapon, but it's, you know, with his training and whatnot, you think he'd be able to handle that situation.
He had multiple broken bones and fractures as well, which, again, she had a weapon, yes, but, I mean, it's extensive injuries to Neville.
As we mentioned before, her ex-husband said she wasn't familiar with a gun, but, you know, we've already gone over how that gun was actually quite easy to use comparatively to other guns.
I guess another part that is leading to Jeremy's guilt and Sheila's innocence more so is that there were numerous people that came forward to suggest that prior to the night of the murders, Jeremy had been overheard saying he could kill anybody. I could even kill my parents. However, Jeremy outright denies having ever said that. Jeremy had also once said of Sheila, "I am not going to share my money with my sister." Again, Jeremy outright denies having ever said this.
So we haven't even mentioned the inheritance has been believed to be about £500,000. So it's, you know, it's a considerable amount of money there. And yeah, it's believed he didn't want to share the inheritance. But also, I've heard a conflicting theory that the family members, you know, the nephews, the one that we mentioned earlier.
The cousins.
They would have lost all the inheritance. They would have went to Jeremy and they would have hated that idea.
Yeah.
So maybe them finding the silencer and all that stuff, they were happy to kind of taint him with all that as well. But obviously that's quite a far-fetched theory, but some people believe that one as well.
Well, that's the one that kind of Jeremy to this day believes his family have set him up, and his cousins now stand to gain more from the inheritance than he was able to. He's consistently made various appeals to get kind of access to his inheritance and parts of the estate that he felt he was due to get. And yeah, I mean, the whole intruder theory is kind of one that's been ruled out, but, you know, there were windows that still opened from the inside that only people having been in there before would have been aware of. So perhaps you can't completely rule out.
I guess with the intruder one, unless the police and Jeremy did actually. But then why is Jeremy saying that? Why is the father saying that Sheila's on?
Yeah, Neville's made the call.
Because it's either Neville's made that call and that is happening, or Jeremy's made that call up.
Yeah.
So that kind of makes you not think they'd be an intruder unless it's someone who Jeremy is hired to go in and do it. One of the big things to support Jeremy's innocence is from new photo evidence was that Sheila's blood was wet. Some of the evidence that was not made available for the defence before the year 2005 were photographs of Sheila taken by a police photographer at around 9 a.m. on the 7th of August. They showed that Sheila's blood was still wet, and if she was killed before 3:30 a.m., as the prosecution said, her blood would have congealed by 9 a.m. The other victim's blood had congealed and dried by this point.
Yeah,
so that is a big one, because it's like, unless Jeremy had killed everyone in the house, but there's no marks on her of a struggle, left her until the very end, shot her, went out, called the police from his house. That one's a real kind of...
Very far-fetched, but it could still happen.
A head-scratcher. Yeah, it's... So he rang at 3:26 a.m. saying all this had happened. And yeah, if she was killed before that time around 3:30, it would be congealed by 9 a.m. So that one for me is a real,
it's big,
because all the other bodies were found in a very different state to her.
It's brutal as well. June and Neville in particular, very, very brutal murder. So if it was Jeremy, he's obviously, maybe it's a mercy killing for the his nephews, but Sheila is quite relatively straightforward comparatively to June and Neville.
Mm.
Like, there's a lot of aggression with both of their deaths and a lot of external injuries.
True. And one of the statements from one of the first officers to enter the house at 7:34 a.m. who is PC Peter Woodcock, dated the 20th September 1985, said of Sheila, she had what appeared to be bullet holes under her chin and blood leaking from both sides of her mouth down her cheeks. So again, the wet blood. And the photographs would go on to support that as well. The only photographs of Sheila seen by the defence during the trial did not include her feet. They found photographs of her body that did include the feet and showed she had blood on them. If she had walked through a house where four murders had taken place, she would be expected to have blood on her feet, but it was a part of the prosecution's case that her feet were clean. So like you said, conflicting to what you said. Again, there's a lot of conjecture in this. The fact that her feet were covered in blood would then, yeah, it would make sense her walking around the house. But then again, you could argue she maybe should run away from Jeremy. It's not clear from that. Another thing said about the photos, there was no sign of rigor mortis and the skin was not discoloured, which again leads in with the idea of how long the body's been lying there. All those things, it very much muddies the waters there.
I mean, to go into the motive, there was a lot of money attached to the will, as well as all the land and property and business that the Bambas own. So their business, N&J Bamba Limited, was worth £400,000 at the time, which is over £1 million now. And in their wills, June had left £230,000, which is about £608,000, and Neville £380,000, which is again just over £1 million. So multi-million pounds worth of money here. During the murder trial, the court had heard that the Bambas had basically left their estate to Jeremy and Sheila to be divided equally. In addition, Neville's had that kind of amendment to say that it would only go to Jeremy if he was still working at the farm.
Yep.
However, it was alleged, and they heard from the mother of, they heard this from the mother of Jeremy's ex-girlfriend, that June had said she wanted to, or had been saying that she wanted to change her will to bypass both children and go straight to the grandchildren. So that could possibly again be a motive for the twins to have been murdered that night. The parents' estate included land and buildings occupied by Jeremy's cousins, who were made aware after the murders that Jeremy intended to sell that land. So again, a lot of the fingers from the family are naturally pointing towards Jeremy. And during the trial as well, one cousin actually moved into the White House farm, while several of the other ones tried to acquire full ownership of the caravan site that the family owned, as well as other buildings on the farm. So yeah, there's just a lot going on in the family.
So there's a lot of vultures circling there, it seems. Another thing to support the idea that Jeremy is in fact not the killer was some missing phone logs were found. And these are quite, if this is true, then it really does kind of strengthen the case. Lost phone logs that were later uncovered backed Bamba's story. One of the logs previously unseen suggests Bamba's father, Neville, did call police on the night of the massacre at the White House farm in Essex. The note written on August 7th, 1985 is titled "Daughter Gone Berserk" and timed at 3:26 a.m, 10 minutes before a second note records Jeremy Bamba's own distress call. It states, "Mr. Bamba, White House Farm, daughter Sheila Bamba, age 26, has got hold of one of my guns." So both, if he's rang the police saying exactly what's happening, then rang Jeremy, that surely is enough to be like, well, that's exactly what happened.
Definitely. I mean, there was very contrived evidence at the trial and limited evidence as well, because allegedly it's Jeremy that said, oh, well, it's a murder-suicide, burn it straight away, which that's a strange reaction.
That is, yeah.
If you're believing straight away that it's your sister that's responsible, rather than it could be the wider family or an intruder.
There was another really weird thing I heard, which was Colin, who was talking about the murders, and he said, like, he looked at Jeremy immediately afterwards as a brother, kind of looking after him and kind of making sure he was okay, obviously both grieving. And he saw Jeremy kind of acting very strangely. At one point he run upstairs and he had spiked his hair in the same way that one of the twin boys had done in the bath. There's a famous picture, well, there's a picture from the case which has one of the boys in the bath doing like kind of liberty spikes, like spiked his hair in 3 points, like Krusty the Clown kind of style, I guess. And Jeremy apparently was run upstairs giggling with that hairstyle, and then he saw someone spot him and he kind of then quickly brushed his hair down, and which is very odd behaviour. I mean, on the documentary I was watching, they said like how many traits he has that will be psychopathic traits.
Yeah.
Enjoying, seeing people like struggle and not having much emotion, not being able to have much empathy. And another thing was apparently he, after spending a lot of the money, he wanted to generate more money. So he contacted someone from The Sun, and he basically was trying to sell them pictures of his sister, of her using, and they said, a cucumber as a sex toy and a vibrator. The editor, luckily, of The Sun, weirdly, you'd have thought that they were just the pits. But they don't print anything like that, but print the fact that he's trying to sell this.
Yeah, make a bigger story out of that.
Make a bigger story out of that, the fact that he was acting that way about his dead sister. So that immediately, again, that's a very, very odd and questionable behaviour for someone who's, well, anyone's behaviour doing that is very, very questionable. So,
yeah, I mean, at the time as well, I know we're kind of jumping between lots of different suspects here, but at the time, June had previously been sectioned and diagnosed as psychotic shortly before the murders. So some people suspected June having, you know, having suffered some form of breakdown and then taking it out on the family. But obviously the injuries to June kind of immediately rule that out. Obviously, Sheila had had her own demons and her own issues that she'd battled for many, many years. So that did kind of weigh slightly in Jeremy's favour. Neville, Tom mentioned his RAF friends. He also had spent some time working for the Secret Service, and apparently four of them were murdered in very suspicious circumstances.
Yeah, I think massively overly egged that. I think it's a 10 earlier. But yeah, that in itself is a huge one, how they've all died in mysterious circumstances. There's other reports of there being two silencers were found at the farm, but the jury only showed told about one. A lot of the marks on the body, apparently, when it was trialled out on a pigskin, I believe, shooting from a distance without a silencer, shooting close with a silencer, it was determined that from that particular rifle, like against the skin when shot, that's the closest they could get to it. Without, so it didn't have a silencer, they believed. But from those tests, they said the mark on the body is more reminiscent to someone shooting against the skin without a silencer. Which then, if that completely throws out the silencer, like the blow poke in The Staircase, great documentary, highly recommend it. If you throw that out, then that immediately completely wipes out a load of the theories. And you can say, well, she could have shot herself.
Yeah.
And the silencer, like, because it's been argued as well, the DNA found in the silencer doesn't actually quite match up. It's like a very, very small percentage of... I don't know where I sit on it at all. Jeremy's behaviour, in some instances, is just appalling. But then with Sheila saying before that, she believed that the children were the devil, the suicide note. Yeah, the suicide note apparently was saying what she was doing about killing herself and exactly what happened to the family. So if that note did exist and the police mysteriously lost it or it didn't make sense in the narrative they wanted to lead, then...
So then to go off if the gun was used without the silencer then and it was Sheila, then I can't buy into that as much because her nails were absolutely... I know I keep going back to the nails, but her nails were absolutely pristine. Because it was alleged as well that she would have then, after committing all of this, had a ritualistic bath and then changed her outfit, is why they're saying she was in such a pristine...
Well, she had blood on her feet, according to that. But then that's the thing, lots of this is... One team are saying this, one team are saying the exact opposite. I mean, Sheila, obviously, she's not doing this for any... If she did this, she's not doing this for any gain other than maybe putting herself out of this misery. But with Jeremy, obviously, there's a financial gain.
Yeah.
It's very tricky to kind of pinpoint exactly why would this happen. The Secret Service thing about Neville getting killed, I don't believe they would kill the whole family in that instance. They would just kill
children
him.
Yeah, well.
They'd just kill him. If it's the other reports of the people, I'm sure it wasn't all the family was killed as well, because then that would be made into a much, much bigger thing. Very baffling. And again, the frustrating thing with this, I mean, apart from the police burning evidence at the beginning of the case and then burning it later down the line, going, oh, I thought you were done with it. It's like the John Monet thing. It's like evidence that could have been kept pristine, which would have been able to use today with better techniques, that could have uncovered this, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very tricky to unpack. And it's like, when you watch documentaries with any of the family involved and Colin, the Sheila's ex-husband, they're all 100% adamant, definitely Jeremy.
And we're hearing, obviously, the Louis Theroux series that's due to come out as we're filming this is very much a different take, and it's very much pointing the finger at either Sheila, an external family member, or the intruder theory. Yeah. But it's who stands to gain the most, and I think that's why it's very easy to, with Sheila no longer being here, to point the finger at Jeremy. But at the same time, he behaved very strangely. During the sentencing, the trial judge described Jeremy Bamber as warped, callous, and evil almost beyond belief. And there was not a lot of public sympathy for him at the time as well. A lot of the national media were reporting it was obviously he had crocodile tears at the funeral and that he stood to do it all for a financial gain.
I mean, Dan, has that changed any of your thoughts here?
Not really. I was going to say one thing, we don't have to put this in, but right at the start you said when the police arrived with Jeremy at the scene, there was figures dodging around in the house. Is that...
It's been said by some people and said not said by other people. It's, again, one of those
things of this, which is incredibly irritating. There's a complete opposite opinion on each thing. It was reported, apparently, first off, that they had seen things. Yeah. Because if you went to the house and it's completely dark, silent, and you waited out there for an hour, you probably would look to go in if you thought people were dying in there.
Yeah.
That's another big thing for me. Although there were, like, fractured relationships, it was alleged in the months building up to the murders as well that June and Jeremy weren't talking to each other whatsoever. But the thing that, and yes, there was a lot of tensions within the house, but the thing that really stands out to me is Jeremy waited outside that house knowing that potentially what was going on, and that it was family and his nephews and sister and parents could have all been, you know, potentially saved. And he's not tried, as far as we're aware, not tried to enter the house or just, you know, telling police, go, go, go. There's no kind of sense of emergency from him or urgency. So it's a horrible situation to try and put yourself in. But if that was my family, the first thing I'd want to do is try and get in the building. But maybe he did and it just wasn't reported. But
that's the thing, as I said, like so many conflicting things have been reported, you never really know the actual ins and outs of it.
He's called a local police station instead of 999, thinking that 999 wouldn't have been able to get there as quick when they probably would have got there quicker.
We're going to move on to now some trivia about the case and some other facts and details, and then move on to lookalikes.
So first things first, the White House Farm. So the White House Farm itself, the farmhouse, now belongs to, or allegedly the land upon which, belongs to East Coast Classics, which is a classic car and camper van rental company that have a collection of iconic and classic vehicles to rent for events such as weddings or even family holidays.
And with staycations recently, they'll probably make a murder.
Oof.
Make a murder? Doesn't make sense.
Killing. Whilst the address of White House Farm is inhabited by East Coast Classics, there have also been reports that Jeremy Bamber's cousin, Anne Eaton, who now who played a massive part throughout the case as well, giving evidence against Jeremy, now lives at the farm, having moved in following the 1985 murders. So Jeremy has expressed a lot of disgust towards Anne and her decision to live at the farm, calling her an odd and morbid human to want to live at a crime scene. Anne moved into the farm with her family shortly after Jeremy's conviction. She has stayed out of the public eye and declined to give interviews.
In 2004, Bamber was attacked by a fellow prisoner with a knife while talking on the phone and needed 20 stitches. Again, I think it's one of those high caliber, well, high, well-known inmates. People want to make a name for themselves there. He now spends his life in HM Prison Wakefield in Yorkshire. And in his first year in jail, he's alleged to have received over 50 love letters. So Jeremy actually commented about the TV series, the one you really like on ITV, calling it a disgrace. Speaking to the newspaper from prison, he said, "The ITV drama is a disgrace. It is being broadcast in the middle of a review and it is likely to interfere with the CPS being able to pursue the option of a retrial. It is promoted as a drama, as Carol Ann Lee's book that is based upon is, for the most part, simply made up."
Yes, it is. There are even states at the start, you know, it's been dramatised for effect. But the research that went into that show was extensive. And it's very well cast. It just gives you that kind of...
That doesn't mean anything.
Well, it is. There's some great actors in there.
I'm not debating that. Okay. But if you're trying to get out of prison and someone puts a drama out... Let's say you're Bamber and you're innocent.
Yeah.
A drama goes out which essentially says you're the guilty party.
I wouldn't really mind about who's cast. You've got a very valid point.
But
there.
Also, it's like it's people watching it and they go, "Well, that's exactly what happened."
Yeah, yeah.
Because we even discussed that with this case and with a case we're doing soon, dramatized versions of it. Mm-hmm. Not good for doing research.
Not good for doing research, but it gave you that kind of fly on the wall perspective into dramatised events. But
yeah, which isn't helpful.
Which I enjoyed. It was a good watch.
Yeah, that's not what we're debating here.
Yeah. Well, I've not entered any kind of debate just yet.
Fun fact, I know the guy who plays Jeremy. Oh. Freddie Fox.
Wow.
Lovely stuff. But tell him, don't use it for research.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. An ex-detective, Mark William Thomas, who helped uncover Jimmy Savile's sex crimes, believes Jeremy Bamber is innocent and believes Sheila murdered the family before she took her own life. And he writes to him in prison and is committed to helping him. So, you know, another detective there thinking that he is innocent. There's a Jeremy Bamber Justice Group on Facebook, which has 1,200 members, and a discussion Facebook group with just under 1,000 members. So if anyone wants to have a discussion and chat about it, there's some groups on Facebook for you to join.
Yeah, lots of quotes in the build-up to that fateful night. One in particular is alleged that Neville apparently told his secretary, Barbara, whilst Sheila and June were obviously both going through various battles of their own relating to one of Sheila's miscarriages, that Neville felt he was very sure he was going to be shot accidentally by Jeremy on one of the family hunts.
It's a very peculiar thing to say.
Yeah. He had no one he could talk to. Obviously, with Sheila and June you know, facing their own issues.
Maybe the police.
And obviously the ex-girlfriend as well, Mugford, there's motive there for her, but based on her being dumped. She said that Jeremy had told his uncle, I could kill anybody, I could even kill my parents easily.
Wait, how does the conversation get there? Like, I could kill anyone, including my parents. Well, that's... What, two old people?
Again, another one from Neville's secretary, Barbara. She told reporters that Jeremy used to provoke his parents relentlessly and that any time he visited the farm, there were arguments. She told reporters that Jeremy used to ride circles around his mother on a bicycle wearing makeup to upset his father and once hid a bag of live rats in Wilson's car.
He's very good at catching rats.
He's very good.
Well, the Pied Piper.
Grew up on a farm, so...
Don't think that's a skill that you just get, though, is it?
Probably closer.
Any farmers watching, let us know if you just have a natural ability to catch rats. Ben believes you do. I'm open to be taught differently. And on that note, Ben, we're going to move over to the lookalikes.
Yeah.
This was really friggin' well hard, I found.
So anyone joining us via audio platforms, every episode that we do has a fantastic opening intro made by
our very own
producer, Dan. And that those intros are typically accompanied by animations by the brilliant Phil Witten at Phil Witts. And he has said that he believes Jeremy Bamber looks like Gary Numan.
Here in Mecca.
Shout out to Phil there. And if you want to look at our animations, why not follow us on Instagram? At Good Murderer Pod. For me, I struggled. I've got one for Neville, who was cast brilliantly in the ITV series. I'll say it again. But I think Neville looks like a cross between the BFG and the farmer from Babe. For me, I think a young Bamber looks like a young Ricky Gervais, and a young Bamber looks very much like my dad.
Yeah, we discovered that last night, didn't we?
Yeah,
we both
had the same lookalike.
I was like, I'm not going to say this in the case because I don't want to be taken the wrong way, but I was like, looks a little bit like your dad.
Yeah.
When he was younger, you're like, oh my goodness, I had that too. And here we are. I really struggled with Bamber. Electro kind of 80s band. Yeah, Newman, like Phil said.
Bowie.
A little bit Bowie at times. But then other ones, it's one of those faces where a different angle. Nah, one of those faces from different angles, he looks like a completely different human. My friend Tom Preston, I put up. He looks a lot like him. Though he said, why do people always compare me to people that... are old. So that is our lookalike. I'm sure you guys will have a better lookalike than us, like you always tend to do. So please let us know in the comments below.
An old Jeremy Bamber, I've just realised, looks like football manager Nigel Atkins. Quite a lot, actually.
And that is the White House Farm murders. Very big case. Lots of questions asked. Dan, who's guilty?
Jezza.
Ben, who's guilty?
Jezza.
Tom, who's guilty?
They'll be judged. I honestly don't know. I'm going to think Sheila. Just to be different. Hopefully Louis Theroux can prove that right so I don't look like an idiot. But anyway, it's been a very interesting case to uncover. And please, go watch the ITV drama that Ben said and Dan's mates in.
Yeah, and we're going to watch the Louis Theroux one, so anyone here as a result of that, we hadn't seen it before we did this, so...
It's purely a coinkydink.
Yeah, absolutely. But as always, socials, at Could Murderer Pod on Instagram and Twitter, we post every day there, talk about cases that are coming up, both on Patreon and the main channel.
And we've got Facebook as well, so you know, search us there, we'll pop up on there as well. We also, if you listen to us on audio, Spotify or iTunes, please leave us a review on there or follow us on there. It does really help. Also, we've noticed a little increase on the people setting the notification bell on YouTube. But if you're not part of the gang, join the gang so we can alert you when we're posting. And don't forget to give us a like and leave us a little comment there. We always appreciate it.
We also have the store, icmap.store. And we also have the Patreon page, which is patreon.com/couldmurderapod. And get discount on the store just for becoming a Patreon, which we forget to mention, so I'm mentioning it.
Exactly, smart. Mm. Smart. Anyway, thank you so much for watching us, guys, and until next time... Jesus.
That is loud.
That is a perfect way to end.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
We say this all the time.
I'll just do it like this, Dan. Jesus.
It's quite good, actually, like that.
And like we always say...
We say this all the time.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Well, unless it's making your way onto a farmhouse.
Making your way downtown, walking fast, people passing homebound. Take care, guys.
And I miss you.
creepy.
You have been listening to I Could Murder a Podcast, written and presented by Tom Norris and Ben Carter. Additional voiceover by Finney Cassidy and Jonathan Kidd. Additional research and timelines written by Danielle St. Romain. Produced and mixed by Dan Lambert of Boston Sound. Artwork and animation by Phil Witten. Theme song by Alfie Indra. If you've enjoyed this episode, please remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Just search at Could Murder a Pod. For additional and exclusive content, please check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/couldmurderapod. And don't forget to tell all of your friends.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.